From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at how a new initiative could offer more support to prospective homebuyers of color.
Every year, we have 17,000 Black and Latino families that are aspiring to buy a $125,000 home. But there's only about 1,500 available on the market, and about half of those are purchased by investors.
In our monthly With Mosley conversation, we'll learn about two women-owned businesses creating fall fun for Milwaukeeans. Plus, as Landmark Lanes turns 95, we look at its history and how it continues to meet the shifting preferences of Milwaukeeans.
The Landmark, in many ways, is kind of like Milwaukee's original activity bar. It's been here, obviously, 95 years. It's not even just one bar, it's three bars and a full bowling alley and an arcade.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Milwaukee has the second lowest Black home ownership rate in the country. Recently, Wells Fargo announced they're giving over $7 million to support home buyers of color. The Community Development Alliance, also known as CDA, is figuring out how the grant money will be spent. Along with city officials and organizations throughout Milwaukee, CDA will lead a new initiative to dismantle systemic barriers in home ownership for people of color. Teague Whaley-Smith is the Chief Alliance Executive for the Community Development Alliance. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang.
According to U.S. Census data, Milwaukee has the second lowest home ownership rate of major cities in the United States. And Teague, just to start off, why is home ownership so low here in Milwaukee?
Well, the first thing to understand is how important home ownership is when it comes to the stability of families and neighborhoods. I think intuitively we understand this, but there's recent research that shows that stable housing can help kids have a 30% lower dropout rate, can boost employment by 20%, and can reduce crime by 20%, even homicide rates, if we invest in housing. So housing and home ownership is critical. And fundamentally in Milwaukee, our housing system has become unstable because we have so many people that have been forced into rental situations. We have the second worst Black home ownership rate in the country. That doesn't happen by accident. That happens by a set of systems that are available to some people and not others. And so at the Community Development Alliance, we led a year-long process to explore those root causes and develop strategies around them. And our goal is to advance racial equity by providing a quality, affordable home for every Milwaukeean. And for Milwaukee, that means we need systems to support 32,000 new Black and Latino homeowners.
Yeah, and definitely with this new funding from Wells Fargo, how will the money from Wells Fargo be used by the city of Milwaukee and really led by CDA?
This investment by Wells Fargo really allows us to turn to a new chapter. We know what the legacy of poor systems in place for Black and Latino home ownership and what that's done to our city. And it's time for a new chapter. So we have a lot of momentum, and the Wells Fargo investment is going to allow us to turn that first page. This isn't going to happen overnight. These problems have been hundreds of years in the making and are going to take decades to fix. But it's important that we take that first step and turn that first page. For us with the Wells Fargo gift, one of the biggest things that we're focused on is combating predatory acquisition. Had the families that got homes built for them in the 1950s sold to Black and Latino families as they moved into larger homes, we would have no racial equity issue in Milwaukee. But unfortunately, those folks sold to investors, and about 50% of that affordable housing home ownership stock was sold to investors. And every year, we have 17,000 Black and Latino families that are aspiring to buy a $125,000 home, but there's only about 1,500 available on the market, and about half of those are purchased by investors. So the acquisition fund that we're setting up with Axe Housing, the Axe Housing Homeownership Fund, will allow us to acquire properties that would be otherwise sold to landlords and preserve those for homeownership.
Tell me a little bit more about that. What does that process look like? What would that impact be?
Yeah, so the 1,500 properties that are sold each year for $125,000 or less, about half of them are what we call portfolio sales. And this has been a growing issue. In 2017, there were only about 100 portfolio sales, meaning 100 properties that were bundled together in, you know, two or more properties for transactions. That number is now almost 800 a year. So this is the problem of our time. This is the racial equity issue of our time. Of course, we understand the history of redlining and other things that have happened in the past. This is our now, and we need to address it. And so what we are doing is setting up a $10 million fund that will allow Axe Housing to acquire properties from other landlords or from people that would be selling to landlords, fixing up those properties and selling them to families. We are incredibly blessed to have a $1 million gift from the Zilber Family Foundation to cover upfront staff costs. And the first $2 million of the Wells Fargo funding will be put into this acquisition fund. And we hope to have contributions by the city and the county through ARPA funds locked up before the end of the year.
Earlier this year, Wells Fargo faced some scrutiny when Bloomberg reported that the financial institution rejected half of its Black applicants in the 2020 mortgage refinancing boom. And they found that the bank accepted just 47% of all Black borrowers' applications. And just in comparison, 72% of Wells Fargo's white customers had their application approved. And across all major lenders, Black applicants had lower approval rates than white applicants. However, Wells Fargo had the largest disparity, and it was alone in rejecting more Black homeowners than accepted. And with these recent events in mind, on top of the historically racist housing practices in this country, how will the City of Milwaukee and the Community Development Alliance make sure that these funds are used equitably and making sure that these practices don't repeat themselves again?
In order to change turn the page on racial equity in Milwaukee and home ownership, no one entity can do it by themselves. We had 100 stakeholders participate in the collective affordable housing plan that has been approved by the city and the county and several other institutions across the area. And we all have a role to play. And it's important that we all acknowledge our own personal history or business history and the systems that are in place. And I think it's really beautiful that Wells Fargo has said, you know, hey, we do have a role and as a bank to switch these systems and these trends. And the $7.5 million that they're bringing to Milwaukee will do just that. About $3 million is going to be for down payment assistance for Black and Latino homeowners, together with increasing homebuyer counseling. $2 million will go into the acquisition fund that I mentioned. And about $1 million will go into our strategy to build entry-level homes for Black and Latino families, which has never been done in the city of Milwaukee and most other areas. If you look at the housing stock in Milwaukee, about 95% of it was built prior to the Fair Housing Act, when it was still legal to discriminate against Black and Latino families. And then after you were legally required to offer housing, we stopped building it in Milwaukee. We had already grown to our fullest. So we never have been able to build entry-level housing for Black and Latino families. And this Wells Fargo money, together with the other philanthropic support that we've gotten from the public and private sector, is going to allow us to do some of these systems for the first time. But the Wells gift can't do it by itself. It's going to take other financial institutions, insurance companies, you know, other folks that have been part of systems in the past, to really step forward and say it's time to get rid of some of these old systems and put new systems in place.
With CDA's work and with your collaborative work across the city with different nonprofits, with the City of Milwaukee and different organizations, what does moving towards racial equity in housing look like for Milwaukeeans here?
We need systems to support 32,000 new Black and Latino homeowners, and you can't do that in 1 year. And so it's important that we stay focused. And right now we need to change the trend of losing 1,000 families of color each year in home ownership to things like predatory acquisition, to gaining 1,000 homeowners of color each year by being smarter about the way that we build new housing, by being smarter the way that we do lending, and otherwise all collaborating with the specific goal of racial equity. I think that people that are part of larger institutions, whether that be employers or governments or other organizations that aren't already focused on housing, to really talk within their own networks and say, hey, are we having trouble retaining employees because they have housing instability? Are we having trouble serving people in healthcare because people have housing stability issues? And I think that's something that we can each do on an individual basis, is to look at who our colleagues are, to look at who our neighbors are, to look at who, you know, the people that we serve are, and really ask that question, are they in stable housing? Because the data shows that 50% of our population is not. And I think together we can really change these systems. And CDA is here to support that. So if there are people that are working on strategies and need access to the data and the other strategies that we have, that's what CDA is here to partner with. These issues have come about in our country, you know, very specifically disadvantaging a certain group, and we can't ignore that. We all have to stay within the boundaries of the fair housing laws, but there are things that need to be done to target these investments towards people that have been excluded from these systems really since our country's founding.
Teague, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Mallory.
Teague Whaley-Smith is the Chief Alliance Executive for the Community Development Alliance. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang.
From Milwaukee's NPR, this is Capital Notes. We break down the big political news affecting Wisconsin. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. He provides a roundup of what you need to know this midterm election year. Here's our conversation. Hi, J.R. We're back to Mondays. Thanks for joining us on Capital Notes.
Oh, of course.
All right, so the next round of state campaign finance reports are due tomorrow, but already we know that incumbent Democratic Governor Tony Evers raised $4.5 million over the 37 days in the most recent reporting period. That's nearly double the $2.3 million that Scott Walker pulled in during the same period 4 years ago as he lost his reelection bid to Evers. Any idea what this all means and possibly where Michaels is as well?
Well, it underscores what a strong fundraiser that Evers has been. He's up to about $25 million raised between January of 2021 and the end of August. Now, the governor gave us a press release on Friday with the overview of his report. They had $6 million in the bank to end August, but we haven't seen the full thing yet to know a couple of key things. For example, how much the state Democratic Party give to Tony Evers during this reporting period. Under state finance laws, political parties can make unlimited transfers to candidates. So, you know, we don't know if there's a big chunk of that from the party, but what we have seen is that Evers, even as he's gotten big money from the state party, has had a very significant individual donor network of his own in raising that money. The second thing we're watching for is what Tim Michaels do in this period. Now, remember, this covers late July through the end of August. It overlaps with the August 9th primary and the period when Michaels is trying to get his individual donor network off the ground. Recall during the primary, Michaels had said he was not going to take donations from lobbyists or PACs and was going to limit his contributions to $500 max. After the primary, he said he would take the maximum donation of $20,000, but still not take donations from PACs or lobbyists. So this is kind of a first glimpse of how his early fundraising did. And the early reports aren't great. They suggest that he was kind of had a little bit of a challenge get that off the ground. I mean, one of the selling points for Michaels in the primary was he had the personal resources that once the primary is over, he would make sure that he was taking the fight to Evers and not having to raise money from donors to get back up on the air. We're not seeing that play out. Ad Impact is a group that tracks campaign ads. Governor Tony Evers and the groups backing him, they are outspending Tim Michaels and groups backing him about 3-1 from last week through the election. That is not a great a scenario for Tim Michaels if he hopes to beat Tony Evers.
And does that sort of thing, like, you know, cash on hand, finances, spending, does that always translate into, you know, success for candidates or not necessarily?
No, I mean, if you look at the whole 2018 campaign, Scott Walker outspent Tony Evers by a good healthy margin. The difference was, though, that Evers and the groups backing him were fairly on parity with Walker and the groups backing him in the final weeks. That's the key thing. It's not that Michaels has to be matching Evers and company dollar for dollar, but they can't be outspent 3-1. Now, if the environment suddenly turns way more Republican, I mean, it right now feels like Democrats are feeling better about where things are at. Republicans aren't talking about a red wave or tsunami, but more like maybe just a good year for them. You know, we'll see where that environment goes. But if it's a decent Republican year, you still are taking on an incumbent opponent who's outspending you 3-1 on TV. That makes it tougher. If you want to take advantage of the environment, you have to be somewhere closer. And I'm not necessarily getting 1-1, but like 1.5-1, definitely not 3-1 if you want to have a better chance of beating Tony Evers in November.
So also on the connected to the governor's race this week, Democratic Governor Tony Evers tried a new tactic to repeal Wisconsin's 1849 abortion ban. This law doesn't have exceptions for rape, incest, or the health of the pregnant person. It criminalizes abortion only to save the life of the mother. And he's already called the legislature into special session to repeal the law and also sued to block it. Now, Evers called lawmakers into a special session on October 4th to create a new referendum process so that voters could overturn the law. He cited comments by Ron Johnson supporting voter agency. Legislative Republicans denounced the plan. What can you tell us about this and its political implications?
Well, you know, Evers is looking at avenues to try and keep this issue alive. Obviously, trying to get lawmakers to overturn the ban didn't go anywhere. The lawsuit is moving forward, but there's no promise of action ahead of November election. This is another avenue to talk about. Now, in asking people last week kind of reaction to it, there was some debate on whether this is the best avenue for Evers to keep this issue alive because, you know, he's the governor. He's got the bully pulpit. He can find ways to talk about it. And, you know, the Madison Press Corps has become somewhat accustomed to special sessions being called, being gaveled in and out in the span of about 30 seconds in each house, and away we go. So this is likely to be a two-day story, the day that the governor announced the special session, the day it's gaveled out. I don't think it's going to have any lasting impact beyond that. Now, some people would argue that, look, the base that's unhappy about the Dobbs decision from the Supreme Court that has really jazzed up on this issue, they're going to see Republicans gavel it in and out, and it's going to fire them up some more because they're going to feel like Republicans aren't taking this issue seriously or won't even have a conversation about it. So we'll see how it plays out going forward. But the issue is obviously having an impact. I mean, Tim Michaels on Friday went on a conservative radio talk show host show and said he would sign a bill that created exceptions for rape and incest, the state's 1849 abortion ban. That's noteworthy because he's been getting hit on TV since late August by the Democratic Governors Association with an ad using his own words against him. Michael said in an interview that the ban, which, like you mentioned, only includes exceptions for the life of the mother, reflects his personal position. He told a Dane County GOP event earlier this month that he was not going to back off that position and it would actually be a negative if he did. And here he is now saying he'd sign the bill. Now, he told Dan O'Donnell that the reason he would do that is because it's a democracy, and if the legislature sent him the bill, he would want to work with people on what's going on. The question of these things always is it going to help him with the people he's trying to attract, i.e. voters who are unhappy about the Dobbs decision and don't like the idea of a governor who doesn't accept any exceptions except for the life of a mother? And will it also irritate the anti-abortion base that's been behind him pretty solidly so far this campaign? We shall see. But he's not the only Republican across the country who is trying to take a softer stance on abortion post-primary. We've seen candidates across the country, you know, scrub language from their websites, do ads that have like a softer language, you know, trying to portray them in a different light on the issue. It's just Republicans are finding out this has got some staying power with certain voters. And the question is, does it outweigh issues like crime or inflation when voters hit the polls in November?
Interesting. So we'll keep an eye on that. You mentioned special sessions. Governor Evers has called special sessions at this point on COVID-19, on gun reform, on education, voting, Medicaid expansion, and now several on the abortion law. What does it mean when the governor of one party is calling special sessions that just get gaveled in and out of with no action from the legislature? And really, what's the strategy here on both sides? And what does it mean for people in Wisconsin?
Well, it's a reflection of the fact governors can call special sessions all they want. They cannot, however, force the legislature to actually take up anything or to act. For Republicans, these are a nuisance. They've gaveled them in and out. They have not paid a price for doing that so far politically. There have been special sessions on gun bills, for example, like called red flag laws, you know, things like that. It doesn't seem to have any impact for them electorally. So without there being some kind of penalty, they're not going to really feel any heat about this. You know, the governor, he's frustrated. He can't get his agenda done, which he thinks is a popular agenda. Also, he's not done a very good job communicating with lawmakers or trying to reach compromise with them. I don't know at this point that either side thinks they can reach compromise. But for Evers, it's part of trying to keep public pressure on the legislature and trying to keep the issues that he believes are popular alive and in the discussion with voters.
Is there precedent to this, like so many special sessions and so much inaction?
I've been here for 22 and a half years. I've never seen this many special sessions called in the span of a couple of years. It's not been like this before, no.
And a question about the lawsuit that we referenced earlier about to block the abortion law brought by Evers and Democratic Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call. Call has removed Republican lawmakers as defendants and instead has named district attorneys as defendants, district attorneys of Dane, Milwaukee, and Sheboygan counties. What's that all about?
Well, lawmakers had moved to have that lawsuit dismissed, saying they're the wrong parties to sue. Their argument was, look, we create laws, we don't enforce them. You should be going after the people who actually prosecute things, i.e. district attorneys. And so that's what they did. DOJ was not getting anywhere with that lawsuit against the lawmakers. They had that motion to dismiss. They refiled against the district attorneys in three counties that had clinics that provided abortion before the Dobbs decision, Sheboygan, Dane, and Milwaukee counties. Now, DOJ has gone to the court and said, hey, typically you get 45 days to respond to a lawsuit. They had served the DAs by Wednesday of last week. Do some math that puts the deadline to even respond to the lawsuit in late October. That wasn't going to make it get any action before the election. Call has now asked the court to shorten the window to respond to October 11th. Doesn't guarantee a decision prior to November either, but he's trying to get this thing rolling and joining action. And the argument in the motion that he filed is that this is a key issue for people about their health and we need to get a decision. Well, we'll see. We'll see when it gets done, but they're trying to move that along more quickly because it was filed in, late June? I think it was, and so far we haven't had a single court hearing about it.
Well, Vice President Kamala Harris was in Milwaukee this week. She told Call that, quote, our administration has your back on that lawsuit to overturn the abortion ban. At the same time, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was in town to stump for Michaels last Sunday, and he told him, everything we've done in Florida, you'll be able to do in Wisconsin and then some. What do these visits really accomplish for the candidates, and are you expecting any more high-profile visits in October?
First, last question first, yes, there'll be more. We'll see a lot of surrogates between now and November, especially, you know, with Republicans. If you're thinking about running for president in 2024, doesn't hurt to go in there, Wisconsin, a swing state, just in case, you know, Michaels wins and you have an ally then in the governor's office come that primary in 2024, right? That's not a bad idea. But basically, these visits are largely about free media. You know, DeSantis up in Green Bay ahead of a Packer game. You know, Harris in Milwaukee, where Dems want to turn out the vote in big numbers. Michael's campaign told me that they raised about $500,000, part of a fundraiser that was attached to the DeSantis stop. So there's a benefit there. But for the most part, it's about, you know, the free media you get from a high-profile visit.
And what's your understanding of Wisconsin's importance nationally at this point?
Oh, I mean, really, this is kind of about looking to 2024, because who's in the governor's office is going to be a big deal for in terms of what election laws are in place come 2024, when we expect to be a swing state yet again in the presidential election, and it could come down yet again to, you know, 10, 20,000 votes. And those rules are going to matter. If Republicans get Tim Michaels elected, they will have a whole host of changes to election laws to reflect their frustrations with the 2020 election, how it was administered. If Governor Evers is still here, those laws aren't going to get passed. He has vetoed them before and probably veto them again. So you might have more court cases, more court fights over how our elections are administered. But it's really all about, again, looking forward to 2024 and how important we're going to be in that presidential election.
You know, on that note about voting laws and how elections are administered, this week the Wisconsin Elections Commission started the, frankly, lengthy process of reviewing the rules for election observers. It's an issue that's drawn concern for both Democrats and Republicans, as both sides are recruiting partisan watchers to witness whether election workers adhere to the law this November. The process could change how election observers monitor polls. Do you have any insights on this?
Yeah, so state law on election observers is kind of sparse, actually. It says they have to be between 3 and 8 feet. It gives the power to the local officials to remove those who are disruptive. But beyond that, a lot of the rules are created through the rules process. The election, actually, the old Government Accountability Board in 2014, I believe it was, created a bunch of rules on election observers. For example, you're not supposed to be able to use a recording device in a polling place to tape what's going on. Those rules, however, expired. So the Elections Commission has provided kind of a guidebook to locals about how observers should be looked at, how they should act, what their standards are. They don't carry the weight of law, however. So that leaves clerks kind of on their own to figure out what they want to enforce at the polling sites. They're going through the rules process to try and put those things back in place, figure out a framework for what our standards are going to be. And this is really important because you have Republicans who believe there should be more access, who are unhappy about, you know, 2020, feel like they were too far away from the action to really see what was going on, those kinds of things. So it's going to be interesting to see what the rules package looks like. Worthy of note, it's not going to be in place before this fall. The goal here really is about 2024. It takes about a year to 2 years to pass a rule under Wisconsin's process, so it's not going to happen anytime soon.
All right, well, as always, thanks for the insights, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capital Notes.
Have a great day.
That was JR Ross of WisPolitics.com speaking with me, WUWM's Mayan Silver. Listen for our segments every Monday with an extended segment on Lake Effect, and check out the Capital Notes podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Later this week, WUWM's Mayan Silver will look into the significance of the state attorney general's race and what's at stake when it comes to policies on issues like abortion. Coming up, an Eastside institution is celebrating a major milestone. In about 10 minutes, we'll learn more about the history of Landmark Lanes, which is turning 95 years old this year. But first, we'll chat with Judge Derek Mosley about two Milwaukee women-owned businesses. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's time now for our monthly with Mosley conversation. Judge Derek Mosley joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang every month to share restaurant recommendations, unpack our legal system, and share his personal research on Black history. Judge Derek Mosley is a municipal court judge for the city of Milwaukee, and he's also known as one of the city's food influencers. He joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to chat about two Milwaukee women-owned businesses, that can help you kickstart your autumn fun.
Judge Mosley, it's always great to see you again.
Hello, Mallory. Can you believe it's September already?
It is almost the end of September, and it's about to be October. And for this month's picks, Mosley, you have two businesses that are both women-owned, and one of them has some spooky creations, and another has some very fun fall activities. For your first pick, Judge Mosley, tell me a bit about your first pick and their spooky creations this season.
Yes. So my first pick is Chase My Creations. And Chase My Creations is a Black woman-owned business, which focuses on apparel, gear for pets, kids, things of that nature. And their focus is racial justice, women empowerment, pride, things of that nature. And they have their Halloween collection out, which I absolutely love. There's one with a Black shirt, and it has a white ghost on it. And it says, "Hey, boo, don't be racist." And I love that. I absolutely love it. And then they have the orange shirt that says racism is scary. And I love that for their Halloween collection.
Tell me a bit more about Chase My Creations. Who is it owned by? And why was this your pick this month?
Yeah, so it's owned by Chloe Longmire. And what I love about Chloe is that she's focused on racial justice and she's focused on the betterment of people here, and not only in Milwaukee, but across Wisconsin and the country. And I picked it just because I just like what she's doing. Not only is she making these creations to give to people who live here in Milwaukee, but she also does a thing called the Justice Crusader of the Month, where you can nominate somebody who you think is actually doing things to make Milwaukee a better place. And I think it's kind of cool because that person is featured on her site and they get a shirt that has their name and picture on it. And I just think it's really cool. So I want to give kudos to her and amplify the things that she's doing because she's doing great work here in Milwaukee.
And the other person, the other company that you are highlighting this month is also a woman-owned business, and they specialize in a very specific niche experience. So tell me a bit about the second pick.
Yes, my second pick is the Packed Picnic Company. And what I love about it is I like picnics. I like to go outside and socialize with people, but I hate cleanup. And I hate a setup, right? And what's so great about Packed Picnic Company is that you get to choose from, you know, over 100 Milwaukee County parks. You tell them where you want to be. They will set up everything for you. So that means the mats, the blankets, the pillows, the tables, the cutlery, the glasses, a Bluetooth speaker, so that you can have your own picnic in the park and you don't have to do anything. Once it's over, you get 2 hours, you socialize, you have fun, you eat. They even supply some charcuterie if you want that, or you can bring your own food. But once you're done with your 2 hours, you get up and you just walk away and they will come up and they will pick everything up. How great is that? One. And two, it's my favorite time to picnic because I hate bugs, Mallory. And the best part about fall is no mosquitoes, no flies. It's just nice and cool. And you can be there with your friends. They have blankets if you need to wrap up in a blanket, and hot chocolate if you need it. It's just a great, great idea.
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree. I love being outside when it's fall and autumn again. And Mosley, have you done a picnic through the Packed Picnic Company? Have you done the picnic yet?
As you know, Mallory, I'm a kidney transplant recipient. And so I bought a Packed Picnic for me and my donor because we just celebrated our 6-year anniversary, our 6-year kidneyversary. And so we're going to have the picnic. I have the certificate to go do it, but I have to wait for fall, Mallory. I need no bugs. So we'll be doing it soon.
That's such a special moment, too. I'm really excited that you get to have this experience with your person for your kidneyversary. And what a fun adventure to do together.
I can't wait.
Well, Judge Mosley, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate your pick.
It's so good to hear your voice. So good to see you.
Judge Derek Mosley is a municipal court judge for the city of Milwaukee, who is also known as one of the city's food influencers. He joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang each month, and you can hear their previous conversations at WUWM.com. It's Monday, which means it is time for Bubbler Talk, our series where we answer listener questions about the region. This week, WUWM's Kobe Brown explores what Milwaukee was like during the Great Depression, including the Hooverville that became a part of the community.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Today, Bubbler Talk explores listener Elizabeth Harrington's curiosity about Milwaukee during the Great Depression. She asks, how did the Depression change Milwaukee? Specifically, were there Hoovervilles that were established in the city's parks at the time? When America's economy plunged between 1929 and 1933, Milwaukee's foreclosure and eviction rates more than doubled. Many were homeless, so they moved into the city's Hooverville or shantytown. I spoke with UW Milwaukee's history professor, Amanda Seligman, to find out more about them. She says, Hooverville was a term of contempt for President Herbert Hoover, who some people saw as responsible for the state of the economy. People with nowhere else to go lived in these Hoovervilles.
So that they went to live in these shacks that were sort of equivalent to what you might think of now as tent cities of homeless people, except for there weren't, you know, plastic commercial built tents. They were jury-rigged out of whatever plywood and tin that people could find sitting around.
Many couldn't find housing in Milwaukee, but African Americans had some of the worst experiences. Lack of housing and explicit racist policies forced Black people to reside in the 6th District's Lincoln Park Hooverville. The shacks were small, cramped, and unhealthy. Often they lacked electricity, running water, or even toilets. To make matters worse, reoccurring flooding in the park swept away most of the Hooverville. Seligman says Milwaukee was once the most densely populated city in the United States during the 20th century, which only added to the list of the city's problems. To address these issues, Milwaukee received some of the same support as the rest of the country, says John Miller, the director of Out of Reach. Out of Reach is a documentary that follows Milwaukee through different generations perceiving the American dream.
I think what our film shows and where it is very analogous to the 30s is that the new generation now can't depend on unionized work that sustains you from the time you're in your 20s to retirement. There's a lot of hustle now.
For Americans in the 1930s, Miller adds, substantial relief didn't arrive until Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal program. The New Deal gave cash assistance to over 2,000 Milwaukee families and put over 24,000 people to work through the Work Progress Administration, or WPA. In Milwaukee's Lincoln Park, the WPA relocated the river there and created a large lagoon which constructed four islands. This in turn stopped the reoccurring flooding. Miller says this time period shows that Americans all have in common trying to cope with a country that doesn't always treat people right and has horrible examples of capitalist abuse.
It's a country that doesn't always give people a safety net. And so that means that you have to hustle and you have to work hard to survive. And that has changed. But the American dream in that sense might be sticking together as was shown in the 30s and Roosevelt's New Deal. And it might be the individual hustling and surviving to when the next paycheck does come.
The Great Depression left its mark on Milwaukee, no doubt. From the unfortunate history of the homeless in the Hoovervilles to the New Deal programs that developed the city's parks and constructed new public housing. Kobe Brown, 89.7, WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Landmark Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
Bubbler Talk is a regular series on WUWM and Lake Effect. You can hear it every Monday on the show. And at WUWM.com, you can hear past episodes like the history of Milwaukee's Jones Hill House. And in case you didn't know, you can listen to both Bubbler Talk and Lake Effect as a podcast. If you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. And you can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. If you've ever waited for a movie at the Oriental Theater, you may have found yourself in the Underground City for a game of pool, bowling, or Dance Dance Revolution. We'll learn about the history of Landmark Lanes next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This week, a Milwaukee institution is celebrating a big milestone. Landmark Lanes turns 95. When it was first created in 1927, it would have been hard to imagine how the East Side would evolve in the coming decades. Landmark was originally a part of the Oriental Theater and Oriental Drugs, eventually becoming the underground city that generations of Milwaukeeans have come to know. As a longtime East Sider, Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild is a regular visitor to Landmark, so I met up with him there to learn more about this East Side institution. Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining me here at Landmark.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's I never really need an excuse to come here, but I'm happy to be here right now.
This is a place you actually end up going a fair amount, right? Your daughter likes it?
It really is, yeah. I live fairly close to here, so I find myself these days spending a fair amount of time here at the Landmark on the East Side with my 8-year-old daughter. And we go bowling, we play video games, and we just hang out. And yeah, we're here at least once a week, sometimes two times a week. So it's a hangout.
Now, for people who have never been to Landmark Lanes, and I admit there are probably few, but how would you describe it?
Well, I think it's interesting. In the last few years, there's been such a kind of a push for these so-called like activity bars. That's been a thing in the last 5, 6, 7 years. The thinking is people just don't want to go out anymore and sit and drink. They want to go out and do something else, whether that's throw axes or paint or play board games or whatever it is. And so there's been a lot of these kind of activity bars popping up in Milwaukee in the last few years. And they're great, but I find it funny because the Landmark in many ways is kind of like Milwaukee's original activity bar. It's been here obviously 95 years. And it's not just a bar. I mean, it's not even just one bar. It's three bars. It's not even three bars. It's three bars and a full bowling alley. It's a full bowling alley and an arcade. And of course, you have all the, you know, foosball and darts and all the bar games like that. And on top of that, you have comedy, live comedy here from time to time. And you have live music from time to time. So it's just this kind of entertainment center. It's an activity bar before there were activity bars. So it's called the Underground City. It's definitely underground. It's a rather large basement facility down here. And when you kind of walk down the steps, it's like you're walking into a whole new world.
I think that might be one of the oddest things about Landmark. When you're walking past, it's you know, like an entrance like any that you might see into a storefront, but the storefront in this case looks pretty small. It's really just kind of a doorway between a couple other storefronts, and then you walk down, and it is a full bowling alley, but I mean, where we're sitting right now, it is just one of the bars. There are multiple bars down here. There's a number of pool tables. It's kind of like, I don't know, six places in one.
Yeah, I think Underground City is very apt, and they have that, you know, just a big sign that says this as you're walking down the steps. And you're right, it's like, you know, just one of these bars, the one we're in right now, I guess, is the Moon Room. And there's the front bar and the back bar, and each on their own would be a perfectly serviceable, perfectly lovely little neighborhood bar. But they're all piled on, you know, next to each other, and there's a kind of the bowling alley and the arcade, and it's all down here, and it's all kind of hidden, and I kind of like that. It's very apt. I think the Landmark is a place where I think a lot of people of a certain age have a lot of memories of this place, that coming here in kind of the heyday of like the 90s, 80s, 90s, maybe into the early aughts, And it's kind of a place that I think a lot of folks, as they get a little older, they kind of forget about it. And if I could be a landmark advocate here, I would be here to say that it's still here. It's been here for 95 years. I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. It's still here. It's still largely the same place that a lot of folks remember. They've been doing a little spiffing up here and there for their big 95th anniversary. There's a new marquee outside. There's been, you know, some nice new paint jobs in here. For folks, again, of a certain age who remember this place during the time when we could smoke in bars, it does not smell like that anymore. I think that's one of the most enduring memories of the Landmark for certain people. Just remembering this place when you could smoke and having it packed wall to wall, all three bars, and every single person smoking all night long, and just a haze in here. And I was certainly in on kind of the latter years of that, and it was one of those things where you would just, you could be here an hour, make one or two beers, and you'd have to burn your clothes at the end of the night. I mean, they would just smell so bad. And so those days, thankfully, are long gone. It's not like that anymore, but in so many other ways, it's the Landmark you've always known and loved.
So you mentioned, of course, kind of the heydays of Landmark, but we're talking about actually a space that is, 95 years old. What is some of the history of this space?
Well, as 95 years would suggest, it kind of opened more or less in 1927. It was tied in with the Oriental Theater, which is right next door, of course. And before that, it was like a horse and mule and streetcar barn. So in 27, it kind of became a bar. And in 1972, I believe, it kind of became more or less the bar that we know now, the Oriental Lanes and Theater. And they changed it at that point into Oriental Landmark Lanes. That was kind of, you know, where things were for decades after that. And, you know, even if you look on the Landmark's website, it's funny, they do refer to the like 80s and 90s as their heyday, like just people down here packed wall to wall. It's changed hands in the last decade or so, but it's really remained the same. So it's been this kind of constant thing for so many decades. So when you say 95 years, yeah, before that it was a mule barn, but it really has been kind of consistent for a good chunk of those 95 years. Even the sign that they recently changed and kind of updated outside, there was like an older sign kind of buried underneath the signs they were replacing that said Oriental Bowl that dated back more than 50 years, 50, 60, maybe even 70 years. They weren't even sure. They covered it up again. So, but the new sign does look nice. So it's the real deal. It's just kind of been this thing forever.
There's a brand new sign outside. What I found interesting about this brand new sign, looking at both the sign they replaced and the sign underneath it, remarkably little has changed.
That's right, yeah. You know, people are scared of change. People don't want change. But, you know, looking at it, it was like, sure, this new sign could have been made in the 70s or 80s. It's retro without being, I think, obnoxiously retro. So I think it's very fitting. They did a fine job with it, and I think everyone will just instantly get used to it in about, 10 minutes. So very fitting.
A continuation of an institution, now that you said.
Absolutely, and that's what this place, I think, really is. And like I was saying before, it's a place that I think a lot of people have fond memories of when they lived on the East Side, and maybe in the years since they've moved on to other neighborhoods, they've moved out to Bayview, or even farther flung than that, some have gone way out to the suburbs. But the East Side, I moved here way back in 1996. I've been here ever since. I've never left the East Side. I've kind of just bounced around in a small radius from apartment building to apartment building. And it's really reassuring that this place and this neighborhood kind of sure has seen some change, but the Landmark is still here. And it's something that, you know, people need to be reminded of sometimes. Maybe they haven't been to the side of town in a long time, and I am here to say that welcome back to the East Side. It's there's a lot of things that are different, but one thing that is not different is the Landmark, and it's in my view, lovelier than ever.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining me here at Landmark.
Absolutely, thanks for having me.
Matt Wild is a co-founder of Milwaukee Record. and a longtime fan of Landmark Lanes. The Entertainment Center will be celebrating its 95th birthday with a full week of events that start today. For more information, you can check out their website, landmarklanes.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how a local construction firm is implementing a suicide prevention program. Plus, we'll explore the terminology surrounding Hispanic and Latino communities as part of our Hispanic Heritage Month series. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.